Our second case this morning is United States against Clayton. Counsel for the defense, you may proceed.
Please the court, Chief Judge Efron. Pleasure to be back before you again. Doesn't seem like it was that long ago. That could also be because at my age, my memory gets shorter and shorter every day. Your Honors, I do appreciate the opportunity to argue the case of United States versus Lieutenant Colonel Charles Clayton. And what I would like to do, Your Honors, is sort of set out a very quick preamble to this case and then go into the four main parts of the argument. The government agents in this case, acting without probable cause, illegally searched the appellant's private quarters. That's the basic premise of this case. This case is remarkable for four things. It's actually remarkable for many things, but I'm going to start with four of them. One is the lack of any probable cause, and I'm going to spend some time looking at the four corners of the affidavit in this case. Two is the staleness of the information alleged. Three is the lack of any nexus connecting any allegedly illegal activity by the appellant to his quarters. And finally, the lack of any possibility that the government could argue good faith exception in this case due to A, the false statements by Special Agent McClain, and B, the lack of impartiality by the magistrate.
Have you listed those in the order of strength?
No, I have not, Judge.
Which one do you think is your strongest argument?
Well, I would certainly argue that the lack of probable cause is the strongest argument. I would argue that the lack of a nexus would be the second strongest argument.
Isn't that part of the lack of probable cause?
It is. I set it out separately very briefly, Your Honor, but it is sort of encompassed by the lack of probable cause, and certainly the inability of the government to rely on the good faith exception would be third. Starting with the lack of probable cause.
You just listed all of them. So what's the essence of your probable cause argument? Nexus, staleness, what?
The essence of the lack of probable cause argument is that the government had no information at all that the appellant had engaged in any illegal activity. The government had, and what I'm going to do, Your Honor, is just sort of set out for you the things that the government did not have in this case, which is certainly much more encompassing than the things the government did have in this case. The government had no information that the appellant had done anything more than request what is known as a digest of emails. Senior Special Agent Watson, the ICE investigator who was originally on this case, apparently believed that this was not enough, as he advised Special Agent McClain to subpoena the appellant's Yahoo accounts, which is something that she A, failed to do, and B, failed to apprise the magistrate that she failed to do. The government did not have any information regarding appellant's activities, if any, within this chat group. All he knew is that he had requested a digest.
What does the record show, not with respect to the digest that this appellant received, but with respect to the concept of a digest in this website as to whether it could include an attachment?
And Judge, I'll apologize, I'm having a hard time hearing your question.
What does the record show with respect to the concept of a digest as it applies to this website? Not necessarily with respect to the digest that this appellant received, as to whether the transmission of a digest could include images.
The transmission of the digest indicated that the appellant would receive, or that whoever requested the digest would receive 25 emails back. Special Agent McClain did not know whether or not those emails could contain attachments. Senior Special Agent Watson believed that they could. I believe that was his exact testimony.
And wasn't that provided to the magistrate in this case?
It was.
Thank you.
Your Honor,
what about the federal cases that have held that subscription to a child porn site in and of itself is enough to provide a fair probability for a probable cause?
Well, Your Honor, I believe that the main federal cases on point state that it does not provide that sufficient information. And I'm going to get to those cases in a little bit, which is the Doan case and the other case, which your name escaped me, but I'll be talking, the Weber case, Judge. The government did not have any evidence at all as to what level of activity the appellant had within this particular group. They have no information, in fact, whether or not his request for a digest was even received, and no evidence at all as to whether or not he requested a reply. The government, as the Chief Judge just said, it's unclear from the record whether or not the digest even contained any...
I was asking what the record said. I wasn't asserting what the
record said. I'm moving from your question, Judge, that the government did not have any evidence at all or had very little evidence as to what was contained within the digest. Perhaps most importantly is the government did not know whether or not the appellant had a laptop computer in his room and did not know whether or not, if he had a laptop computer, that laptop was capable of receiving internet.
Okay, turn to Appellate Exhibit 3, if you have it.
Give me a size of the joint appendix,
JA 20.
Yes, Judge.
Okay, there we have a list of IPs. We have two IPs.
Correct.
As I understand it, one is at the office work site and one is at the barracks. Correct? Is that your understanding of those IP addresses?
Not entirely, Judge.
What's your understanding of what those IP addresses were?
My understanding is that one of them belonged to the U.S. Army, and the other one was belonged to a commercial IP server, a commercial server, I guess, in Kuwait, but
providing
certainly not
service
with regards
to the barracks. You contest that that provided wireless access to people who lived in the barracks.
Well, I think that there was certainly some evidence that wireless access was available in the barracks.
So the military judge got that wrong? It's an erroneous finding of fact that there was wireless service provided to the barracks?
No, that's not what I'm contending at all, Judge. I mean, according to the magistrate, in fact, said, I live in those barracks, and it has wireless access.
This reflect that someone logged into the Charles Clayton account using two different IP addresses?
Yes, it does.
Okay. And what does that reflect?
That reflects that.
Two different locations, not necessarily two different computers, correct?
According to, believe me, I'm not the most computer savvy in the world, but according to the record, that's
correct.
That's what
the case is about. So you can't argue this case without understanding what an IP address reflects or does not.
No, absolutely, Judge, and that's what the record reflects.
So it reflects that someone is logging into a Charles Clayton account from two different locations, correct?
That's correct, Judge.
And one of those locations is the workplace, and one of those locations is associated with the wireless access provided by to the barracks.
I'm not sure that I would concede the connection between the wireless access provider and the barracks. The second one was provided by a server in Kuwait.
And the fact that it's always the same IP address reflects what?
Reflects that somebody logging into Charles Clayton at yahoo.com from a computer other than...
And always getting the same IP address when they do it.
Right, so from a computer...
So it's either on continuously or there's only one portal from which they can access that IP address.
I'm not sure I caught the last part of that question, Judge.
Well, if it's a wireless service, there's going to be different IP addresses you can lock into using that wireless.
Correct.
Correct? But
yes.
Here, the person is always getting the same IP address.
Yes.
So there's either only one port of access, or they're continuously logged on.
Correct.
Okay. And you would concede that that is what this factually indicates?
Correct. Yes, Judge.
Thank you.
Do you know if that information was presented to the magistrate?
Well, based on the four corners of the document, Judge, it was not. And that's where I was going to turn next, is that if one turns to the four corners of the document, there is certainly much discussion about, or at least some discussion, about the government IP address, but not with regards to the private IP address that Judge Baker was just asking about. Perhaps most importantly, Your Honors, is the government had no information at all that Lieutenant Colonel Clayton had ever accessed the Internet from his quarters. They had no evidence that he had ever done so. They had no information that he had ever received, viewed, or asked for a single piece of child pornography. And that's where I believe that the government, the court's request for separate briefing on the McComber case comes in. In McComber, if you'll recall, he actually requested child pornography. In this case, they had no such information.
And your distinction there is between specifically requesting the digest and specifically requesting photos.
Well, in the McComber case, they certainly had much more than that, Judge.
But I'm asking you in this case. You said there's no evidence that he requested child pornography.
That's correct.
Are you contesting that whether there is evidence that he specially requested a digest from the group moderator by which he would receive daily emails that could contain 25 combined postings to the group?
I am not contesting that he requested a digest. The government had no information that he had ever specifically requested or certainly had received.
So your issue there is whether or not the digest necessarily includes child porn.
Yes, Judge.
Versus people yapping about it.
Yes, Judge. And in fact, I believe that McComber points out that difference quite well. And I believe it is also, I'm drawing a blank on one of the other, this court's other opinion on that area. I believe it's the Gallo case where this court talks about the interest in child pornography does not necessarily mean the collection of child pornography.
Counsel, how do we evaluate a case like this where you have alleged that there were false statements in the affidavit and there were omissions, which you're alleging were material omissions? Do we just take out what everybody admittedly recognizes as being false and include in the omissions and then make a determination? Do we have to make a determination whether those were reckless to begin with or intentionally false? I mean, what's our standard in this area?
I understand, Judge, and I don't think that this court can simply take out the false statements and put in the omitted statements and then say, well, what would Major Lyons have done?
But isn't that what we said in Gallo?
I believe it is what you said in Gallo, but I don't think you can do it in this case, Judge, simply because we believe that, and we allege in the brief, that Major Lyons misconstrued and misstated his role as the magistrate in this case.
But that's a different issue.
Well, but I think it's part and parcel. I mean, you can't put yourself in the mind or in the place of somebody who is misreading the law and say, well, now we have to say if this statement comes out, these statements come in, and Major Lyons does not misconstrue his role as a magistrate, what would he have done? And I don't see how the court can do that.
But I don't understand how that is distinguished from Gallo, the ruling in Gallo.
Well, I think in Gallo, Judge, you didn't have that the specific issue of the magistrate specifically misstating his role. Now, if the court's, Judge, maybe I'm misunderstanding your question.
But in Gallo, the way I understand it, what we said was that we could strike the false entries and include the omissions and then determine whether or not there was probable cause.
And I was just getting ready to say, Judge, I think I misunderstood your question. I think I understood it as you asking me what would Major Lyons have done in that circumstance.
No, I'm asking what we would do. Where are we at this point?
The court can certainly do it in accordance with U.S. v. Gallo. Yes, sir. Now, Your Honors, and so that sort of brings me to the next part of the argument, which is looking at the federal cases that Judge Urban asked about and looking also at the military cases. In United States v. Weber, the appellant actually ordered child pornography, but the circuit court held that was not enough as there was no evidence he had actually received it. And we've already talked about United States v. McComber, where the appellant took significant steps to obtain child pornography, subscribed to child pornography groups, etc. And this court held that that was enough. However, I would also point this court, as I do in my brief, to New York Video, the Supreme Court case. I think New York Video is a very important case with regards to the facial invalidity of the affidavit in this case. In New York Video, the Supreme Court upheld the search, but they made it clear that the strong preference is that the affidavit provides sufficient detail for the magistrate to make a decision. In this case, of course, there was no discussion of the material they were looking for because they didn't know what they were looking for. They had no information as to whether or not the appellant, whether they were looking for information that had come in over the internet, because they had no information that he had, or whether they were looking for information that might be otherwise stored. The government could not describe the information for the magistrate because they didn't know what they were looking for.
Well, don't you think that paragraph 3B gives sufficient detail about what they're looking for? Matt, do you think that that's really your best argument?
Oh, I'm not saying it's my best argument, Judge, but I'm saying if you look at New York Video, paragraph 3B is not enough.
I mean, they say file servers, desktop computers, zip drives, magazines, books, et cetera, related to child pornography. What more detail do you think is required?
New York Video said that you should. The preference is to actually describe what is on the videos or what you believe is on the videos that you're looking for.
But they let it in.
They did let it in that case. Yes, sir.
Well, Counsel, Weber is a 1990 Ninth Circuit case.
Yes, sir.
And in 2006, in United States versus Gord, the Ninth Circuit held that evidence of a subscription, even to a mixed site, one offering both legal adult pornography and illegal child pornography, provided the necessary fair probability to look further. For as a paying member, a subscriber has manifested his intention and desire to receive and possess illegal child pornographic images.
And the difference in Gore, Your Honor, is there's a couple of differences. One is the fact that the appellant actually had to put in credit card information and actually had to request and did order specific child pornography.
But here there was no charge for any information.
Because he wasn't receiving, because the government had no evidence that he was actually receiving child pornography. All they knew that he was receiving was an email digest.
But do we know if the website charged for
there is no information in the record one way or another as to whether or not the website charged. Your Honors, due to the time, I'd like to move on to the third argument, which is the lack of nexus, and then the fourth argument, the lack of good faith. The government, in United States versus Kabelka, I believe it's pronounced, which is an Air Force case, and also U.S. v. Lopez, this court's case, the standard is very clearly set out that evidence of crime in one location does not necessarily provide the basis for probable cause for another. Here, the government had no evidence at all that appellant A had committed a crime, and B that he had committed a crime with, if he had committed a crime, that it occurred within his quarters. And in fact, as stated previously, they had no evidence at all that he even had the ability with the computer that he had to access the internet. And finally, Your Honor, with regards to the lack of
counsel, what was established as to the availability of wireless internet access at that location?
There were two things established. One is Special Agent McClain said that she recalled seeing an AFI's promotion advertising wireless internet. And two is that the magistrate said, I live in those quarters and I knew that there was wireless internet.
Is there anything appropriate with the magistrate considering either one of those factors?
Not at all.
Thank you.
What they did not have, Judge, was any evidence at all that the computer that he had, if he had a computer, which they didn't know, was able to receive wireless internet. And one has to remember that back then, now, of course, all computers have wireless internet access. Back then, they did not. You had to obtain special, a wireless call.
Is that established in the appellate record of this case?
I don't believe that evidence
was that established by the defense at trial in this case.
I believe it was in the defense at trial. In the defense at trial, Judge, I'll have to look further. I don't know the answer off the top of my head. I see that my time is out.
You'll have an opportunity on rebuttal.
I will on rebuttal discuss the last act. Thank you, Judge.
Thank you. Counsel for the government.
Good morning, and may it please the Court. My name is Major Adam Kazin. I, along with Colonel Norman Allen, represent the United States in this matter.
Counsel, what's the answer to the question as to whether the military magistrate knew there were two IP addresses accessing Clayton?
In fairness, Your Honor, it's not entirely clear. On page 242 of the record, the magistrate is discussing that he did talk about IP addresses with the magistrate, but there was a lot of confusion in the terms during his testimony. The term ISP, which is Internet Service Provider, versus IP, which is Internet Protocol Address, were confused. The exhibit that you referenced, Your Honor, is a list of gateway IP addresses. And so they don't necessarily go to a particular computer. They go towards sort of the gateway into the Internet, and one was a commercial service internet provider. One was U.S. Army in Kuwait.
So is it your view that the military judge had his finding correct or incorrect when he said there was no evidence that Lieutenant Clayton had ever accessed any website from his personal quarters or that he had a personal computer there?
The government the military judge did not rely upon the second IP address or the fact that Colonel Clayton, the appellant, may have owned a computer. That was not something he based his ruling on, so the government doesn't rely on a ruling that the military judge did not make.
And now I'm shifting specifically to this, which is a broader question, though, which was, do you agree then, or is this clearly erroneous, that there was no evidence that Lieutenant Clayton had ever accessed any website from his quarters?
I don't think the government does not have an issue with that finding, Your Honor.
Or that he had a personal computer there.
The government at that time did not have specific evidence of a personal computer, nor does it require to. And I would point this court's decision to Gallo.
I want to make sure that that's a correct finding, and then argument why it doesn't matter. But I just want to make sure.
I think abuse of discretion is good for one, is good for the other, Your Honor. And that's an important point. I first want to make is that this is an abuse of discretion standard, and there's really two levels of deference we're talking about here. So it's not just whether or not another judge in another circumstance might have found something different.
Counsel, why don't you continue on with the line of why it doesn't matter that the magistrate did not have specific evidence of personal computer in the quarters.
In Gallo, it was a federal magistrate issuing a search authorization for a personal computer and a home based on in internet connections to the government computer. The appellant was downloading child pornography from his government computer, and the federal magistrate issued a search authorization for home and personal computer. And what this court said at page 422 of Gallo was, it is reasonable to infer that the additional materials would be secreted in a place other than his office. And so we look at the totality of the circumstances to look at whether or not it was reasonable to believe that the child pornography they were looking for was in the quarters and if the accused had a personal computer. And a lot of that goes towards the nature of the contraband that we're talking about here. We're talking about digital child pornography, essentially a digital photo. Now, what they did know was that this website,
in Gallo, didn't they have testimony or didn't they have an affidavit talking about the fact that people that look at child pornography and download child pornography like to keep it close to them?
Yes, Your
Honor.
Isn't
that exactly the sort of information that was in McComber and that's not was not presented to the magistrate here?
I think that if you look at the sort of the paragraph one of the search authorization here, you have something similar in the sense that the offenders share the information via email, they download the information, they store it on various media storage devices. So I think you have similar information in this affidavit. It's not quite the pedophile profile information that we see in many search authorizations nowadays, but you do have the information that's stored on a variety of media storage devices. And so following the Illinois versus Gates standard of the totality of the circumstances, what we're looking at here is the reasonable belief that the contraband is in a particular location. And we look at all the attendant circumstances, the first being, of course, the nature of the contraband. One is the computer that we're talking about is a laptop computer. The government computer is a laptop computer. It's all located on Camp Arif, John. His office is in 506. His quarters are in 507. It's also something that is, as this court described in McComber, digital child pornography is easily transmittable, is very easy to store, is very easy to transfer. One piece of child pornography can easily be converted into 50. So we're looking at the nature of the contraband as well.
But can you point me to where in the affidavit that was presented to the magistrate there was detailed information based on the agent's experience as to why they believe the child pornography would be in the appellant's quarters? Point me to the specific line.
Joint Appendix 54, Your Honor, the second paragraph down, talking about the storing it on various media storage devices and often receive illicit email material via email as a result of sites visited. So I think that gives them what are they looking for? They're not necessarily looking for a computer. They're looking for digital media.
But where is it tied to his quarters?
Well, there's not a specific. We know that these people also keep it in their quarters.
So do you agree that this is a different case in that respect than Gallo and McComber?
Not entirely, Your Honor. I think that the inference is still fair. I don't think you necessarily have to have the affiant saying it's typical to keep your digital media storage devices in your home. I think that the totality of the circumstances beyond an agent's expert opinion can lead to a reasonable inference as to where that information may be. And if you look at Major Lyons' testimony at Major Lyons' testimony, he was looking at, as is at Joint Appendix 193, he was thinking, what is the place it's most likely to be? And in his opinion, it was his living quarters. And again, it's a fair probability, it's a fair inference. It doesn't necessarily have to be more likely than true or not. It simply is whether or not it is a reasonable or a fair probability. Now, again, when I go back to what they did know, they knew that this was a preteen bestiality website. There was actual child pornography distributed on the website on October 18th, 2006. There was a posting containing the image of digital child pornography. An appellant affirmatively requested from the moderator, in this case the moderator being Candyman, digest notification. And digest notification is right in the affidavit, says that you bundle together the 25 emails, the 25 postings, and you distribute it. Now that certainly gave everyone reasonable belief that he had digital child pornography going to his Yahoo account. The amount of it, the fact that he might have a defense to it later, all those things are not relevant to a probable cause determination, because a probable cause review by a military magistrate is not an adversarial proceeding. It's not presenting defenses, presenting alternative theories. It's looking at whether or not there's a fair probability there's contraband and that contraband is in a particular location.
Since it's not an adversarial proceeding, isn't it important that we consider omissions and whether they the effect of the omissions on the probable cause determination?
It is certainly, Your Honor. And any type of false statement or misleading statement needs to be reviewed in there, but it needs to be reviewed in its totality. The false statement that is being alleged in this case is sort of in that preamble of the search authorization, the line about the Camp Arif John CID office is currently conducting the discovery of apparent child pornography. Now, the agent admitted sort of in the thing that that was an inartfully drafted statement. But what the Supreme Court has reminded us again and again, and this court has reaffirmed again and again, is that it's not a review from a legal technician, not a lawyer. So it's really sort of fuzzy language. I'm not sure what currently conducting the discovery of. It's sort of a weird combination of adverbs and verbs.
But isn't the point of that 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 gave the impression that they had discovered child porn?
And I would point your attention to Major Lyons' notes as well as Major Lyons' testimony. He was never confused. He even said that they didn't know for a fact. And when you say know for a fact, I'm speaking in terms of preponderance of the evidence or proof beyond reasonable doubt. And if you look at his notes, he was never confused as to what they were looking for. And so there was nothing in there that was necessarily misled Major Lyons.
I thought at some point the magistrate said that he was under the impression that Clayton had received child pornography.
And I think that was based on the digest notification. And, you know, he said, I reasonably believed it. He made that final determination that based on all the information that was provided to me, primarily that digest notification.
Including the statement that's being contested right
correct,
now.
Correct, Your Honor. And I think if you were to excise that statement out, as the court says to do in Gallo, you come up with, there's nothing that changes. The information that's in the rest of the affidavit still supports the military magistrate's determination of a probable cause.
Is there any information, material information, that was omitted that in your view should have been included?
No, Your Honor. And again, this goes to when you talk about a material omission, that they know something for a fact and they hide it from the magistrate versus them telling the magistrate all the things they don't know. I don't think that they know for a fact that he had child pornography at a particular location. No, because that's not the probable cause standard, and they don't have to throw that into the affidavit. There's no fact that was materially omitted.
What information did the magistrate have that the digest included or would likely include pictures and that sort of thing rather than chat?
Well, the affidavit itself talks about the digest, and it talks about the would contain 25 of the postings, and then it also says that that one of the postings contained child pornography, and their belief that therefore there was a possibility is what the agent used that there was a possibility that there was actually child pornography there. So certainly there was, if you look at the affidavit as a whole, that inference exists that the attachment on October 18th was in there. We also included, also attached to this was Appellate Exhibit 1, and I apologize, this isn't in the Joint Appendix, it's Agent Watson's report, also talks about the October 18th posting that was in there. So if you read all that together, again, the totality of the circumstances, the magistrate made a fair and reasoned fair and reasoned determination that he had received child pornography via his contacts with the preteen bestiality website, and that was located in his digital media, and then that digital media could either be in his office or in his very close by quarters.
Counsel, going back to the question of false information, page 18 of your brief, it appears that your position there is that as a result of the dialogue, there was no longer any false information presented to the magistrate, that the actual facts were cleared up. Is that your position, or is there some information that was left that was incorrect before the magistrate, and you're now arguing that it was insignificant?
I'm sorry, say that again.
I'm not clear what your argument is as to the false information presented to the magistrate. On page 18 of the brief, it appears to be that your argument is that as a result of the dialogue between Lyons and McLean, any incorrect statement by McLean was then clarified. But in the course of oral argument, it sounds like you're arguing something different, that there was information that was incorrect, that was left before Lyons, and your argument here is that it's not significant with respect to the probable cause determination. So what is the government's position as to whether there was any incorrect information left before Lyons after his dialogue with McLean in the course of making the probable cause determination?
The military judge determined that statement, that sentence that I quoted to Your Honor, was, in his findings, incorrect. I'm not sure if there's really a distinction between false information and incorrect information.
Now, I understand that it was incorrect. Was it incorrect at the time presented to Lyons and then clarified, or did something remain incorrect after McLean's dialogue with Lyons?
There was nothing incorrect after the dialogue, Your Honor. It's a confusing statement, and I think that that's the best characterization of it. It is a confusing statement, but it's not misleading in the sense that somehow Major Lyons did not know what they were looking for or what was out there.
Okay, so it's the government's position that Major Lyons was left with a confusing statement as to McLean's view with respect to that matter.
No, the affidavit, that one sentence in the affidavit could be construed as confusing, but when you're looking at whether or not he was misled, looking at the testimony of Major Lyons, looking at the testimony of the agent, they knew what they were talking about. The affidavit didn't necessarily reflect what they meant. And what the agent testified to was, when I wrote that, that's not exactly what I meant to say. But in their discussions, they all had an understanding of what that sentence meant. Addressing the, and sort of moving from there into the good faith exception. The good faith exception in here applies fairly clearly, and the military judge said it applied and made findings, and there are specific findings by the military judge that deserve great weight. One is he made credibility determinations as to both Major Lyons and as to the agent based on their testimony, and the words he used to describe both Major Lyons and the judge made a credible determination as to Agent McLean, saying she was extremely professional, extra careful, conscientious, demure, not aggressive, and thorough. So they looked there and said, but this wasn't an agent that was out to get an officer, as sort of was implied in the briefs and in the trial motions below. This wasn't a reckless.
You're not concerned about the apparent friendship between, an association between the magistrate and the judge in the terms of the credibility determination?
No, Your Honor, and I don't.
Does that make the credibility determination more credible or less credible?
I don't think there's any reason for concern. One is it was all talked about on the record. It was all very above board. The other is that it was a professional, it didn't really say a friendship. He had professionally supervised this person and was giving his professional assessment of this person's experience as both an attorney and a magistrate. He didn't really kind of, everything was in there. There was nothing hidden from anybody. And the other was all.
That doesn't mean it isn't. It should receive the same weight as a completely neutral, objective observer's judgment on credibility.
I think it deserves the exact same weight, Ron. I'm not
exact
saying
same weight because it's public. So as long as you say I'm really biased, but we all know that, should all be happy because I'm being transparent.
No, I think there was no bias there. I think the military judge was giving a objective, reasonable view of this individual, and Major Lyons testified. He was up on the stand, so everything he gave was certainly a subject to cross-examination. He was available for the court. It wasn't just I know Major Lyons. We don't need to hear from him because I know the guy. But also both Major Lyons and Agent McLean were discussing, I'm sorry, the judge were discussing the agent's actions, and that's really, the first prong of this test for whether or not the exclusionary rule goes is whether or not there was a deliberate, reckless, or negligent conduct, and none of those are here yet. There certainly was nothing deliberate. There was nothing reckless or grossly negligent here, and there's no systemic negligence. So the agent, even if she erred, even if she should have put more information in there, even if she overstated something, certainly doesn't rise to the level of requiring the exclusionary rule.
I guess the question that I have, and it goes back to the question I asked you before, how, in light of the fact that there's a finding of fact that you don't disagree with, that there's no evidence that Lieutenant Colonel Clayton had ever accessed any website from his personal quarters or that he had a personal computer there, isn't it facially deficient with respect to evidence that child pornography would be found in that particular place?
I don't think it's facially deficient.
Other than that, that's one of the places that they've asked that the search be conducted.
Well, I don't think it's facially deficient, Your Honor, because, again, it's a common sense look at, where do we think this evidence is? And again, we're looking at, and McComber specifically discussed this, both in reference to the probable cause, but also the good faith exception. It's the nature of you're also looking at the nature of the contraband.
But in McComber, there was evidence before the magistrate tying the nature of the contraband to a particular place. There's no such evidence here. There's no evidence from which that inference can be made, at least that I see, in the affidavit. I mean, we can't rely on the evidence in the McComber case to provide a reasonable probability in this case.
No, Your Honor, I think that, and some of the concerns that were in McComber regarding sort of there was also the problem of the the staleness aspect of it as well. There's a 14-month gap that the military magistrate didn't know about versus the 5-month gap that the military magistrate did here know about. But I think if you look at the affidavit and you look at what they're looking for, the proximity of the locations, the transportability of the computer.
And I think proximity of location is based on building number?
Building number also, it's in a military installation on Camp Arif John in Kuwait, Your Honor.
Is there any evidence in the record that literally indicates where these buildings are in relation?
No, Your Honor, there's not. But again, it's sort of a
sequencing of the building numbers.
Yes, Your Honor. And again, when we're looking at this, and again, with the great deference we give to the magistrate, that the, it's sort of a common sense. It's not a hyper-technical view of it. And so, again, when we looked at something like Gallo, again, Gallo, even though there was this sort of expert opinion from the agent, that really went more towards the probable cause determination and absent the nexus. I don't think that they relied necessarily on that in Gallo for the nexus. They simply said that it was reasonable to infer that they would be in a place other than his office. So, I mean, they didn't even say it would be in Gallo. The court didn't say it would be in his home. They just said, look, this is digital child pornography.
Well, speaking of the great deference that we give the magistrate, what do you do with the statements in the record where when the magistrate testified, he seemed to be saying that he was granting the authorization to help them establish probable cause?
I don't interpret, and again, a lot of that was during cross-examination, Your Honor, so I don't interpret
the... He says here, my role was to try and determine whether or not there was evidence by granting them the ability to search.
When he
responded to the question on the wireless internet card, they asked him, did you have an idea whether or not he had a computer or whether he had a wireless card? He said no, but the purpose of the search authorization was to find that out.
Well, I think in the context of all of his testimony, Your Honor, what I think the magistrate was saying was, look, I don't know for a fact. There's a lot of those questions about, did you know this for a fact? Did you know that for a fact? And of course he's not going to know that for a fact. Otherwise, there would be no reason for a search authorization or a search at all. It's part of an investigative process, and what the Fourth Amendment requires is that there's warrants based on probable cause and that there be no unreasonable searches. But whether or not he was acting reasonably, the military magistrate's view of what his role in was, look, I'm not here to determine whether he's guilty or innocent. I'm here to determine whether or not there's enough evidence to search. And that's all we're doing is searching. And so I think that there's been a lot of conflating of standards here of what the military magistrate's role was and that he somehow had to give appellant the benefit of the doubt on a lot of questions. And that's not the military magistrate's role. He doesn't have to give the appellant any benefit of the doubt. He simply has to look at whether or not there is a probability of contraband and the probability of that being in a particular location. Here there was two reasonable locations for where digital child pornography or the media that digital child pornography might be on, and that was in his workplace and in his quarters. As my time expires, if there are no further questions, I can briefly conclude.
Please give a brief conclusion. Thanks.
The military magistrate properly determined that there was a fair probability that appellant possessed child pornography on digital media, either at his office or his quarters on Camp Arif John. The military judge's legal review of that decision is in step with this court's precedent. The military judge applied the appropriate legal analysis to factual findings that were supported by the record. Both the military magistrate and the military judge are entitled to the appropriate deference mandated by law. This court should affirm.
Thank you, counsel. Does the defense have rebuttal? Take your time.
Thank you, Judge. Your Honors, I'd like to focus on two things and then talk about the good faith exception. One is I'd like to sort of follow up with Judge Ryan's last question with regards to the scope and the nexus between the appellant's work computer and his allegedly owning having a laptop with internet access in his quarters. If you follow the government's logic, which is once they knew that this was out there, it's digital media, they could get it anywhere. To follow that logic, the fact that they had an IP address from an Army computer in Kuwait would give them probable cause to search everywhere on Camp Arif John, if not everywhere in Kuwait. And clearly that is not what the law allows. Secondly, Your Honors, as it relates to the United States v. Gallo, which the government relies upon, I think it's important for this court to remember that in United States v. Gallo, the appellant actually received child pornography on one of his computers. So certainly there was a much greater nexus there than there is in the instant case, in which, again, the government had absolutely no evidence that the appellant had done anything illegal. I would like to spend a couple of minutes talking about the lack of good faith in this case, subject, of course, to any questions by members of the court. The lack of good faith in this case focuses on two things, one of which has already been discussed. That is that on page, joint appendix page 240, the magistrate incorrectly states the standard, and he does this in several cases, to follow up on Judge Urban's question, in which he says, I think my role was to try and determine whether or not there was evidence by granting them the ability to search. The government can no longer claim that the appellant is acting as a neutral and detached magistrate when you combine that statement along with his statement at the joint appendix on page 239, in which he says, it would have been, when he was asked about the lack of certain evidence, he says, it would have been good to know, but I don't think it would have made a difference because we don't know what we are searching for. We don't know what we, and then it trails off at that end. Clearly, at that point, Your Honors, the magistrate had placed himself in the shoes of the investigator. He is considering himself part of the team, and again stating that his role is to determine what illegal contraband there may be by granting the search. Secondly, as it relates to the lack of a good faith exception, and we have talked about this to some degree already, but I'll be brief, are the false and incorrect statements and omissions by Special Agent McClain. Perhaps most notable of all of those is the fact that nowhere in the affidavit or in her alleged, or in her discussions rather, with the magistrate does she tell him this very salient fact. We have no evidence that the appellant, or at that time the accused, Lieutenant Colonel Clayton, has ever received any child pornography whatsoever.
Now, are you arguing that's reckless, or are you arguing that's intentional falsity, or are you arguing something else?
Well, Judge, I certainly can't put myself in her shoes, so I don't know what her intent was, but it certainly seems at a bare minimum to be a reckless disregard for the truth. Whether or not she intentionally didn't do that, or whether or not she didn't do that based on her relative inexperience with child pornography cases, and as a CID agent, I can't put myself in her shoes, Judge.
After she concluded her dialogue with Lyons based upon the testimony at trial, what remained to be false? I'm not talking here about omissions, but an affirmative falsehood.
Well, contrary to what the government says, we do not believe that the information contained in paragraph 2, I believe it is, of the affidavit with regards to we are investigating the discovery of child pornography. I don't believe that question was ever cleared up in the magistrate's mind, and certainly not in the magistrate's testimony.
What of her statement remained to be false after her dialogue with Lyons?
That they were currently conducting an investigation into the discovery of apparent child pornography, because and I'm looking at the exact quote, within one of the CFLCC computers and the suspected login user was Lieutenant Colonel Clayton. They did not have that information.
It goes back to that same sentence.
Yes, clearly, Judge. They did not have that information, and that statement is false. As it relates to the remainder of the information not provided by the magistrate, those are clearly omissions as opposed to commissions. Subject to any further questions? Yes, Judge.
I have a question.
Yes, ma'am.
Do you have a view as to whether or not the affidavit that was provided to the magistrate was facially sufficient or facially deficient with respect to where the contraband would be found with respect to the barracks room?
Well,
do you understand my question?
I'm not sure I do, so I shouldn't answer it yet.
Okay. I asked the government a number of questions about the statement in the affidavit that there was no evidence that basically that he had a computer or that he looked at child pornography in his room. Given that, do you have a view as to whether or not whether that causes the affidavit to be facially deficient?
Oh, we argue that it clearly does, Your Honor. We argue that absent some information that the appellant has A, committed a crime, and B, that evidence of that crime is likely to be found in the place to be searched, then the affidavit is deficient. And that's according to,
I think the question does it converted it not into a deficient affidavit, but a bare bones affidavit, which should not be given any weight? Is that putting it into the good faith
whether
category,
it be an exception,
not just into a better or worse dynamic?
One of the exceptions to the good faith exception to the warrant requirement is basically a bare bones affidavit or a facially deficient affidavit. And so what I'm asking you is, do you think that statement makes it just not, it could have been a better affidavit, or do you think it causes it to fall into that category of exception?
There are, I'm doing this off the top of my head, there are four exceptions to the good faith requirement. One of them, which deals with does it properly describe the location? And well, in this one, it at least gives a building number. It doesn't give much more than that, but it does give a building number. But it does not give the information that the judge, that you just mentioned, Judge, and I think that that does make the affidavit facially defective, that it, that the omission to, the failure to tell the magistrate whether or not evidence, the appellant or the accused at that time had committed a crime and that evidence of that crime is likely to be found in the area searched, renders the affidavit facially defective. Does that answer your question, Judge?
Yes.
Thank you. Members of the court, subject to any further questions, that concludes the argument. Thank you very much, Judge.
Thank you, counsel. And we thank counsel for both parties for your presentation today. The case is now submitted, and the court will stand in recess pending further order of the court.
All rise.